little did I know, 10 years later, I would find out my department produced basically two softcore porn videos. So it's absolutely appalling and just a completely unprofessional place.
Welcome to a special episode of Conduct Detrimental. I am Dan Lust. I'm joined by Stephanie Weissenberger. Today, we are performing a deep dive on the Washington football team. The story at the center of football between emails, between Dan Snyder, certainly centers around our nation's capital of Washington, D.C. So this is a first on Conduct Detrimental. Normally, you know, we bring on lawyers, sometimes members of the media, and talk about sports law issues, but this time, I believe a first, we're bringing on the people who know firsthand about what happened. We're going to have on this episode two former employees of the Washington football team, Anna Nunez and Megan Imbert, both of which have retained an attorney, Lisa Banks, with respect to this investigation. So the purpose of this episode, it's going to be a little bit of a different tone than we normally take on these shows, but I think I speak for everyone here, and maybe the general public. It's a little troublesome when there are allegations of a toxic workplace, sexual discrimination, sexual harassment against Dan Snyder, the owner of one of 32 NFL football teams, and there's no written report. We know about 10 bad emails amongst the 650,000 that Washington football team gave to investigators. We haven't seen anything else. There's a level of lacking of transparency that's certainly alarming. So we wanted to go directly to source and see what people had to say that were in Washington Football Team HQ to talk about it kind of raw, unfiltered, and very candid. So Stephanie, you know, I know you grew up a fan of the Washington Football Team. You were taking the interview with me. I don't know, I guess floor's yours. What do you think about these investigations, these allegations, and, you know, Anna and Megan?
First of all, I think that it's fantastic that they were willing to come on and share their stories, just because I know we spoke about it briefly, but, you know, if the NFL isn't going to release the findings of this written report and what all of these women courageously came forward and said, then, you know, someone has to do it. And I think that it's great that they're finding us to be a platform to share their stories, because, you know, growing up from the Washington, D.C. area, Dan Snyder was always, I never really understood why people didn't like him, but that was kind of a known thing, was Dan Snyder wasn't always the best owner. And it wasn't until, you know, recently where I really understood why. And I think that especially for women in sports, you know, Anna was saying how she left sports completely after this. And that's, you know, detrimental to the women in sports movement that I think we're trying to facilitate here. I know that obviously there's a power dynamic there. And I think that it's something that needs to be talked about. And if the NFL isn't going to talk about it and isn't going to man up and talk about it, then someone has to. And, you know, I'm really appreciative that these women felt comfortable enough to come forward and share what happened.
You know, I think it's an important story for any fan of sports. You know, the team that you're rooting for is, for lack of a better term, being held kind of hostage by an owner that won't leave. There's not really much you can do other than speak out and apply pressure. You can talk about Donald Sterling with the Los Angeles Clippers or Jerry Richardson with the Carolina Panthers, both attached to some kind of, you know, racial, I don't even want to say racial allegations, but, you know, racial comments that they were both allegedly tied to. So under NFL or the NBA, it's almost essentially unprecedented for an owner to be forced by the league to sell the team. But you can apply external pressure. And we talk about it a little bit with Megan and Anna. But, you know, that's what fans have to do. Fans have to speak up and apply pressure, because at a certain day, fans are going to control sponsorships. And sponsorships are the money, and money talks. The only reason that the Washington football team is now called the Washington football team is because FedEx Field, you know, sponsor of the field, sponsor of the stadium, threatened to pull sponsorship money if they didn't change the name. So Dan Snyder, once upon a time, NFL is a private entity. Dan Snyder owns it. He goes, we will never change the name. I remember the quote was never. Guess what? They did it. And they did it because of fans speaking up. So we wanted to do our part. You know, actions speak louder than words. We talk a lot about what Dan Snyder did was despicable, but at a certain point, you know, these are allegations, but not everyone's hearing the allegations because the NFL won't release the emails, you know, so we got to get that stuff out. And I think on a personal note for myself, podcast listeners know I'm a dad to two girls. One is 2 years old, one is 4 months old, and hopefully they're both sports nuts like myself. You know, I heard Anna's story. Anna worked for the San Antonio Spurs, worked for the Washington football team. She was on a path, you know, to working sports. And then she just said, this is not something I want to be associated with. So, you know, that was my daughter. I would feel crushed that sports let her down, something that she wanted to do her whole life. So, you know, this is an issue that affects everyone. It's too simple and too lazy to say this doesn't affect me. I don't care about the Washington football team, or I'm a guy and this doesn't affect me. This should affect everyone. It should be on everyone's radar. So, Steph, I don't know. I credit you. You had some good comments on this. But so here's the deal. We've talked about this in bits and pieces, but I want everyone to kind of understand the time frame. Megan and Anna talk a lot about a lot of things. They talk a lot of first names. We asked them to explain them, but we gave this to you kind of raw and unfiltered. We didn't want to cut them off or give any context. We just wanted them to give their stories. So in July of 2020 is when this Washington football team investigation got started. That was by an attorney that Dan Snyder picked. I don't know who was necessarily paying the bills, you know, but imagine Dan Snyder's paying the bills for the attorney that he picked. I imagine the NFL, because when this investigation got started, wasn't footing the bill because the NFL wasn't involved in the investigation. So in the months leading, I'm going to say weeks and months leading up to July of 2020, about more than a year ago, Washington Post revealed the story about cheerleaders. Cheerleaders brought these claims against the organization and saying it was this really bad culture. So as a result of this Washington Post story and comments by former employees that were specifically cheerleaders, Washington Post produced the story. There were some reports that the story was going to be a lot worse, and they peeled it back a little bit the last second. So that investigation starts in July of 2020. About 6 weeks into the investigation, maybe a little bit more allegations come out, but pertaining to non-cheerleader employees. And we'll talk about some of them on this, but this, you know, allegations involving someone in the broadcast department by the name of Larry Michael, who allegedly put together or said you call it whatever you want to call it, but a wardrobe malfunction or just like a, you know, an R-rated video shoot that cheerleaders didn't necessarily know where it was going, but was made on behalf of Dan Snyder. So that allegation comes out about 6 weeks into the investigation, 6 to 8 weeks in. Then the NFL steps in and says, you know what? We're taking over this investigation. It's now going to be us. You're going to report to us. The NFL investigation is going to report. You got to go through us. So they don't change Beth Wilkinson, the lawyer, but what they do is they say you're going to report to us. So about 6 to 8 weeks into this investigation, mind you that Beth Wilkinson, the lawyer that Dan Snyder picked, is conducting. I don't believe the NFL is involved in any way, shape, or form. This story comes out about Larry Michael, and then all of a sudden the NFL feels compelled to do something. And they say, you know what? The investigation is going to run through us. It's going to run through the NFL. You're going to report directly to us, Beth Wilkinson, the law firm. Again, you can go back in our archives. We said at the time this was bizarre. How are you letting Beth Wilkinson stay on in this investigation? But the NFL does it. Beth Wilkinson is viewed in very highly in some circles, so they keep her on the investigation. So we don't hear really a peep from the investigation for several months. We don't really hear anything. And then fast forward to July of 2021, the investigation goes on for a full year. And Beth Wilkinson then does a couple things. She gives an oral report to the NFL. There's no written scraps of paper. There's no evidence about what she found. Dan Snyder's fined $10 million. We don't know exactly for what. Tanya Snyder, right around this time, Dan Snyder's wife, is appointed co-CEO of the franchise, which I've read some reports that was kind of an off-the-record punishment that Snyder had to step away from the team and that his wife had to assume control, at least temporarily. Read reports and I've heard reports about that. I don't think there's any official record from the NFL that says that. And then there's this email gate. 650,000 emails were leaked, or I don't know if they were leaked. 650,000 emails were identified by this investigation as being kind of outside the scope of the investigation, but that the NFL should look at. So the investigation wrapped in July of 2021. These emails start surfacing in some way, shape, or form around October of 2021. And I guess, at least what I read, there was a summary of these emails that was provided to Goodell in October. But I guess somebody at NFL HQ knew about them ahead of time because the report, the oral report ended. And be that as it may, nobody acts on these emails. Nobody does anything, be it somebody outside the organization, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, they had a report on these. And then these emails come out and it comes out. I think Pro Football Talk had this report that all 650,000 emails, they were not emails from throughout the organization. That was done by a keyword search. They were emails that were specifically either sent to or from Bruce Allen, the former general manager and president of the organization. Now, I think it's an important dilute quick so you can kind of see where everything's coming from. These emails, you know, either sent to or from Bruce Allen, these are the only emails that are apparently came up as a result of this investigation. Megan touched about it a couple of times in this interview, but they don't look at any, at least according to them, they don't look at any text messages of anybody as a result of this investigation. So the question is, why are they only looking at Bruce Allen's emails when there's an allegation of toxic workplace? That means everybody is doing these allegations, right? Larry Michael, the guy who we told you made that secret nude cheerleader photo shoot, whatever you want to call it, and gave it to Snyder. Apparently they don't look at his emails, right? That seems to be a guy to look at. And how about the text and or emails of Dan Snyder? Probably pretty important, but we don't have any reports that they looked at those. So certainly some red flags. And then we talked about it on prior podcasts, but for those coming in new, seems kind of odd. Only look at this guy, you know, Bruce Allen, but then you start reading and you start researching and you listen to us. Dan Snyder has sued Bruce Allen in court for allegedly being the leak of another story tying Dan Snyder to the deceased sex trafficker, Jeffrey Epstein. And by all indications, Dan Snyder's angry at Bruce Allen because he thinks he was the leak for this story or the source for the story, even though the story might not be true. But he was the one that, you know, Dan Snyder, I think, was accusing him of being this source. So then, you know, Bruce Allen was fired by Dan Snyder. So there seems to be some bad blood between the two. So if you're keeping track of red flags, we're about at 10 to 12 at this point, but a little odd, right? Dan Snyder hires a law firm to conduct, you know, quote unquote, an independent investigation. And the only emails they look at in the entire organization are from a guy that Dan Snyder hates. So if you were playing tinfoil hat guy, you'd say, well, it's quite plausible that Dan Snyder told them, hey, make sure you take a close look at Bruce Allen's emails. I hate that guy. He's probably got something going on under the hood. And then all of a sudden, it's not really an independent investigation. All of a sudden, the fix is kind of in. And Dan Snyder's got his fingerprints all over this. So that's essentially the time frame. Megan, I saw Megan's name. She was in the Washington Post story. One of the Washington Post has done a very good job covering the story. Anna Nunez, her name started circulating as a result of these owners meetings. So, you know, just to kind of put a pin on our time frame, the owners meetings were about a week ago. And at the owners meetings, Washington football employees, former female employees within the organization, brought a letter that they wrote to owners demanding the release of these emails and saying, Roger Goodell is essentially saying that you're trying to protect the anonymity of these victims. We don't need to be protected. We want our names out there. Here are our names. We want these emails out. And they kind of hand delivered the letter to the various owners. And separately, a story that we're going to keep very close tabs on, Congress is looking for copies of these letters. They're looking for everything. They you know, maybe going to have Goodell under oath, providing testimony. They're maybe going to have Beth Wilkinson figuring out why this was only an oral report when these allegations are so serious. Why Snyder was, you know, Goodell says that Snyder was being held accountable. What actually, what means being held accountable? What did Snyder do? What is he being held accountable for? So I've spoke a lot, but that's the time frame. You got to kind of know that to kind of walk into the eye of the storm here and hear directly from, you know, two former employees of the organization. So Stephanie, before I kind of introduce our special guest, anything on the time frame? Anything you want to add?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's all a little bit strange that only these John Gruden emails came out and only emails that were between Bruce Allen and John Gruden, who we know Bruce Allen has been a scapegoat for Snyder over the years. And so, you know, it's about time that the NFL releases the findings. And, you know, hopefully this is a start for applying a little bit more pressure on them.
Agreed. So, you know, we talked about their backgrounds on the podcast, Anna and Megan. Okay. So I think it's time, Steph, let's bring in our guests, Anna Nunez and Megan Imbert. They were going to give us all things Washington football team and their stories firsthand. So without further ado, we will turn it over to Anna and Megan.
Anna, Megan, welcome to Conduct Detrimental. How are both of you?
Good. Great. Thank you. Thank you for having us.
We wanted to have you guys on. We've spent a lot of time talking about the release of emails, the release of the written Washington football team report by Beth Wilkinson's law firm or the NFL, whoever has the report, or maybe they should commission a written report. So we thought it best to go directly to the source and speak to former female employees with the organization to tell their stories directly and maybe cast a spotlight on certain issues within the organization. Megan, I know I spoke with you first. Maybe if you can just kind of at the outset, tell us your background with the organization, maybe the roles that you held, and then we'll turn over to Anna.
Sure. So I joined the organization in 2006 as an intern within the media relations department and proceeded that entire season. And then 2007, I returned as a full season intern for the television department under Larry Michael. And then in 2008, I was hired full time, departing in 2011 as production manager, working again under Larry Michael's organization. So I was there for 5 years, ages 19 to 25.
Before this or after this, have you ever worked for any other sports organizations, anything like that?
This was my first experience working for a sports organization. In high school and college, I had worked in the retail industry. I had a number of, actually, you know, I did work, one of my first jobs when I was younger was actually at a golf course at a country club. So I was around golfers, but definitely different when it comes to, you know, NFL.
I would think so. And I know I asked Megan that because I know you've worked for at least one other team in your background, but I'll let you explain maybe the team that you worked for before Washington Football Team and then a little bit of your titles and roles within the organization.
Yeah, definitely. So I'll start with, I worked at the Washington Football Team from 2015 to 2019. So I was there for 4 seasons. My first 2 years, I worked in sales. So in ticket sales, at FedEx Field. And then I went over to the park and worked under the suites department for 2 years. And this was not my first job in the sports world, which was kind of a little disheartening because I grew up around here. This was my team. But my first job in the sports world was with the San Antonio Spurs. So I worked in an NBA team organization that really, you know, I know no workplace is perfect, but they set a standard. In the culture, the history, you know, the business organization and how they do things. So coming over to the Washington Football Team, you know, it didn't take very long to figure out how things were run there. But it's also, you know, I stayed for not myself, but others. And I got to see so much of what, you know, honestly shouldn't be a regular thing to see in sports or any other organization.
You guys didn't cross over in terms of your years because Megan, you were out by 2011 and Annie, you started by 2015. So you guys never worked there at any particular time.
Correct. No. Correct. I also think it's interesting when you look at the women that are on record right now, because Melanie was there obviously the longest tenured time. And then I didn't know Emily Applegate or Rachel. So it's interesting when you look at the situations and the commonalities between the experiences. I know Rachel and I both left without jobs lined up. So it's kind of interesting when you see even the fate of a lot of us are now like in completely different industries. So there's a lot of, we completely moved on.
Let's cover this. And then I want to get into each of you individually. You mentioned two names, Rachel and Melanie. Who are Rachel and Melanie?
Rachel Engelston and then Melanie Coburn. So Melanie Coburn was a former cheerleader, then cheer director and marketing director for the team. I think she was affiliated with them for 14 years. Okay. And she decided to go on record after everything happened where it was exposed about the two lewd videos.
Here's what I want. I'm going to give you guys the floor. I think it's more important to hear from you guys and Stephanie and I. We both have some questions, but you know, Megan, you popped on people's radar, certainly with the Washington Post story. Anna, you've told us you were anonymously in the Washington Post story, but you're okay revealing that now. And then certainly there was some former female employees that were at the owner's meeting recently trying to make your voice heard. And I know, Anna, you've told me that you were one of those people that was kind of making that petitioner, making that kind of movement. So I'm going to give the floor to you first, Megan. You know, just by brief way of background, those who do not know, this investigation into Washington Football Team was created by allegations of toxic workplace, sexual harassment in the workplace. One of the statements that caught my attention, Megan, which I know you're familiar with, was a statement attributed to Larry Michael at the broadcasting department about, we'll say, an inappropriate video that was made seemingly without the consent of cheerleaders involved, and that was produced or created for Dan Snyder. Now, that's an allegation that I've heard. I think it was in the Washington Post story where I first saw it. I'm going to give it to you, Megan. You know, that's certainly a messy allegation, but I kind of want to hear just from the source of what you saw, heard, you know, during your time at the organization.
Yeah, so to correct you really quick, it's actually two videos that we have, the law firm and the Washington Post, one from 2008, one from 2010, both over the period of time that I worked in that department. I remember when I walked into the editing bay, this was back in 2008, where I had seen just a very zoomed in part of a woman's private area. And I was like, That's interesting. It wasn't in a sequence for any type of production that I saw, but I just thought it was a little strange that someone would have zoomed in that closely to someone's region like that. And from there, I just kind of put it in the back of my head. And then obviously working at the place and hearing how people talk to me and other women and everything, it kind of always made me feel kind of skeevy thinking, I hope they never did anything with that type of footage. And then when the July 2020 article came out and Larry Michael, by the way, was allowed to retire the day before that article posted, he was not fired. I have to make that very clear. It gives me chills just thinking about it because he deserved to be fired. I had a visceral reaction. That was my boss. And hearing about all of this coming public, I then naturally was reached out to by a lot of previous coworkers, including a couple of folks in the production department. And at that point, they were asking, are you doing okay? You know, I can't believe the story. In my mind, it was pretty a vanilla article compared to what we know is likely in that report. And something in me, it was my intuition. This, you know, I held on to it for a long time. I texted both of those individuals without their knowledge and asked, were you ever instructed to do anything with cheerleader footage inappropriately? And within 5 minutes, both responded, yes. I literally dropped my phone and I freaked out. And that moment was when I started researching the law firms because I knew I'm going to go back to Will Hobson. I'm going to go back to the Washington Post. I'm going to put my name on this. Originally, I was going to come forward anonymously with my experience. And then when I found out that my department produced these, and I fully trust Brad Baker and the other people that I know close to this story, that it was likely ordered by the owner and delivered through Larry Michael. The two videos are shot and edited to Dan Snyder's favorite bands. And there's a lot of reasons why I think it is valid. So I think for me, once I learned about those, it was just so disgusting and appalling. I knew I had to come forward, and there's no way that I'd be able to live with what I know, not putting my name on it, because as scary as it is, you have to sometimes put your name on these things to get the validity, you know? So that's really what brought me to come forward, more so than my own personal experience. It was this complete violation. And we only know about 2008 and 2010. Those were the years that I was there. I don't know all the other people that worked in that department, but where's 2009? Or was there another, you know, were there more after those years? So I feel like this was a repeatable situation, and it was this, you know, secret project.
Now, you mentioned that you were obviously scared to come out, and I kind of want to break that down a little bit, just because, like you guys, I always wanted to work in sports when I was younger, and I grew up in the Maryland area as well. And so there's always been kind of that power dynamic behind careers in sports, where you feel like you can't come forward, or you can't talk back to someone, you can't really voice your opinion on certain things, because, you know, if you get that name on your resume, then you're set. It's something that everyone wants, and they know that, you know, if you don't want to be there, there are millions of other people that would kill for a job at the Washington football team. And so I guess coming from that stance, what did you feel like in terms of, you know, getting your voice heard, whether it was for these particular circumstances or just in general? Did you feel like you had a place at the Washington football team, on their team, or was it kind of just always in the background?
So there's a couple of things to that question. I think there's a few questions within the question. I would say, one, you can be ostracized when you speak out when you work in sports and entertainment. I've posed this question to a number of people with podcasts. Am I ever going to be able to work for an NFL team again if I ever wanted to? Unanimously, I think not, unless there's actual change that occurs and someone respects my courage and my bravery and the value that I can bring to an organization, or that I did. At the time, absolutely not. There's no way you could have spoken up. There really wasn't an HR department. And frankly, like, for example, my boss was Larry Michael. So you're talking, the person that's supposed to protect you is actually the person that's cultivating this culture. And also, when you get around Dan Snyder and you see how he operates, it's evident that those closest executives are the same way. So also, there's a fanboy mentality where a lot of the men that work there, executive level, they wanted to be liked and approved by the players and coaches. So if I ever had any kind of issue, I'm the replaceable one. I'm the one there on like a $30,000 a year salary, and these people are multimillionaires. So I'd be the first one to go at their disposal. So I think at the time, there's absolutely no way we would have ever been able to bring things to light. And I know there's statute of limitations on some of our experiences, unfortunately, because it sounds like we absolutely would have had a case, at least probably for me. But how would I ever have been able to get an attorney to back me going against a multi-billionaire when I could barely afford rent or food at the time? So when all of this comes to light now, you know, the Washington Post had been trying to track me down for a few years and I kept ignoring them. Then finally, when I saw the article in July, I came forward. But it was definitely a situation where there's great personal risk here. There's folks with NDAs that basically are like, no, I'm speaking out. This is wrong. So when we think about the bigger picture, it's bigger than Washington football. It's bigger than the National Football League. My hope is that we can help institute, with hopefully Congress's help, some actual workplace, you know, new policies. Let's look at NDAs and the use of them in the workforce. So I don't know if I fully answered your question, but that's kind of where my thought was. There was absolutely no way we were going to be able to speak up there. No one cared.
So Anna, you know, I think it's a good transition to you. I mean, you know, you told me, I mean, before we started, that you are cited in the Washington Post report anonymously. And obviously, you know, now you're putting your name out there, but maybe speak to a little bit about, you know, the weird dynamic of telling the story, but not necessarily, you know, wanting to be the name behind it. And then obviously you've now kind of changed your tune. So, I mean, the floor is yours, but I do want to hear, you know, from your perspective, and maybe it will empower others to come forward and put their name, and attach their name to it as well.
Yeah, I mean, when I had talked to Will, actually, it was like the day before the article had come out, and we had been texting with some of the former employees, you know, kind of spreading the word around of who's going to talk to him, this and this. And, you know, Rachel was like, are you going to talk to him? And I said, you know, I think I am. So I had the conversation, and, you know, it's especially at this time when this was about a year and a half after I had left, you know, I had moved on emotionally. You know, I was in a better place. I'm in a better place with my work professionally. You know, so to have all this kind of dug up again, I really had to have like a conversation with myself of are you ready? So the reason I did it was mainly to support these other women who had come forward and to confirm their stories, and as well as to, you know, say my stories that I had experienced there. But collectively, my reason for doing it was, okay, if there are this many women and men collaborating these stories, you know, one more isn't going to hurt it, right? So it's actually going to add more to it. So once the article came out, even then, I didn't know everything that was included in it. So even that brought up all these other, you know, memories of hearing experiences, of witnessing things that I had just repressed in my mind of this isn't normal. Because even with us, you know, you would tell people these stories and they think you're crazy. They think like, what is wrong with you? Like, why are you still there? So then, you know, there is a little bit of shame of like, you know, you're right. Why am I still here? But I'm still here making this measly, you know, 30 grand a year, living in the DC area. But then, you know, then you would talk to your colleagues about it. Like, this was your way of releasing. We'd have happy hours or hang out on the weekend, and we would just vent about everything that happened in the week. And then that was what, you know, kept us ready to go there Monday morning and get ready for the next week ahead. So, you know, part of me, I felt like I wasn't emotionally ready. And I really didn't think I was emotionally ready this whole time, even when we were writing the letters and signing off on them. You know, that's when I started to feel, okay, I can put my name on it. I can put my name on the letter and I can sign it. There's no face technically behind the name, but it's something. And then really the turning point was last Tuesday, where my intention was only to support Melanie going up and just being there for her. And we got on the train and we were talking, and, you know, I think Megan had mentioned this earlier, where, you know, she had left in 2011, Melanie, and I started in 2015. Yet we were able to talk about the same people and the things that they had done, both in her time and my time. And it's because a lot of these men were allowed to be there for so long doing the same behavior over and over again. So we're talking, we're getting ready. You know, my intention was to drop off the letters, get lunch, and then, you know, head back home and maybe take a photo op and say a few things. So the timing that we had arrived there was to me meant to be, because we had actually arrived there late than expected because of our train. We had issues. And then, you know, we're talking to one media, the Post, and then all of a sudden it's like 1, 2, 3, 4 coming at us. There's video like cameras in your face. And, you know, part of me was like, okay, either I can say something or I can walk away. And I know I can walk away, but am I going to be ready for that? Am I going to be fine with that? And I knew I was not, because in my head, I'm thinking back to all the men and women who I know cannot speak, whether it's legally or just emotionally for whatever reason, they can't talk. So I needed to do this for them and myself, honestly. Like, I needed to be able to tell my story, talk about it, and really continue the conversation, because with the end game here, you know, for some, it might not just be the report being released. It's a better culture for the Washington football team, of course. But I think this is to set an example across all different teams and leagues that this kind of behavior, you know, is not okay. And for so long, you hear the terms of, you know, sports is a boys club, you know, it's a man's world, all this. And it's like, no, you can have women at the table and still have fun, still have, you know, the sports live entertainment, you know, you can still have that without making women feel like we're small and insignificant. And that's exactly what this organization did. This is exactly what the Washington football team did. And they fed off of it, because I think Megan had said it before, where, you know, we were replaceable. We know that everyone's replaceable in anything, of course, but you were made to feel like you were small and insignificant. And that if you were replaceable, that you were like the scum of the earth. Right. And you're over here thinking, okay, well, it's not like I'm doing a bad job. You know, I'm doing a good job, but yet I'm still small and insignificant. I'm teaching you how to type up a receipt or print some paper, because that was the whole thing, was that half of these men didn't even know how to use the printer. But, you know, you were teaching them how to do these things, and then they would go and berate you 5 minutes later. So, you know, that's the kind of behavior that just can't continue. And, you know, unfortunately, you know, these situations do happen. They happen often. But what we experienced at the Washington football team was that there was no HR, and there wasn't HR for a long time. So, okay, there's HR now. That's great. Fine and dandy. But these stories, I think, do need to be released, because other organizations need to take a look at themselves in the mirror and really just look and see, okay, what do we need to do? What do we really need to do to be better? And instead of doing it in a reactive, being proactive about it.
Just quick, because you said a lot there, and I don't want to lose sight of like the specifics, right? So it's certainly not okay for any boss, right, to berate you for whatever reason. And it's certainly not okay from a legal perspective not to have an HR department, understanding that things have certainly changed. When you say there was no HR, do you mean that there was no department, or they just swept things under the rug or somewhere in between? And then I guess, Megan and Anna, this is for both of you.
So HR during my time was one individual, and her boss was both the CFO, the, you know, who handles the financials, and HR, which is a conflict of interest, in my personal opinion. It's a conflict of interest. However, it's one person handling not only full-time business staff, but also players and coaches. So you have someone handling over 200 people. And this person also witnessed a lot of these things and, you know, didn't feel empowered to say anything, because she knew, we knew that if she did say something and we said something, nothing would be done.
Well, not only nothing would be done, I would fear that there would have been more retaliation for the person bringing forth the information. During my time, originally there were a couple of people in HR, and then I don't know what year it happened, but there was a bit of a reorg. I want to say it was 2008, But at that point, it was really the same single woman. While she would have loved to have done something, we all knew that it was really just a formality to processing documents, I think. And that's also one of the words of encouragement I kind of have said about even the process of these NDAs. I don't have faith in their record keeping either. So I've kind of joked with people that are really petrified about the NDAs. And I'm like, are they really out there? Like, we don't know. There's people that have actually called the Washington football team to get a copy of their human resource, you know, records. And, you know, they're never followed up with. So I think that that's kind of interesting as well. That's happened during this process. So the verdict's out on that one.
Yeah. And even with those NDAs, you know, we're talking about young, you know, 20 to 23 year olds, you know, like you're not meant to believe that you can't trust an organization. So, you know, you want a job in the NFL, you know, you're reading through it and you're like, okay, I'm just going to sign it. You know, you're not taking it to a lawyer to say, hey, can you read this and make me understand for it? You know? So I think they definitely knew what they were doing and taking advantage of these situations where we were young, we really, you know, blindly trusted them to protect us. So for those who did sign NDAs, they didn't really know what they were signing. They just needed a paycheck and a job. And they were like, okay, I have to sign this. That's fine.
And also I could say from like my role, right? If I started out in media relations and PR and I'm getting purview into, you know, the playbooks, if I'm helping pull these things together for the team, I can absolutely agree that I need to sign some type of confidentiality that I'm not going to go and give it to Jerry Jones. But at the end of the day, you know, the NDA should not be in place to protect treatment that is so harmful and abusive and toxic, potentially even maybe even on the legal side, if we're talking about sexual assault and other things. So this is a whole bigger conversation that we want to work on as well to make sure that the use of NDAs is on the ups, and hopefully Congress takes a closer look at that.
Yeah, I totally agree. You know, you don't want an NDA to turn into almost a weapon for an organization to take advantage of, as opposed to, you know, really protecting your employees and the organization as a whole. But going back to kind of what you guys were both saying about how you were scared to come forward and you thought that no one would listen, I'd love to hear more about, you know, Lisa Banks' role and how she kind of came in and has now helped 40 some women come forward and really, you know, make these people be held accountable. And hopefully at some point they will be fully held accountable.
So Lisa Banks and Deborah Katz, if people follow them, they're very well respected, you know, and the Wilkinson firm in fairness is well respected as well. They've obviously gone toe to toe in a couple of major congressional hearings and things like that, Judge Kavanaugh and those sorts. But after the July 2020 article and Emily Applegate was on record, I did not know Emily, but I reached out to her immediately and I just asked, I hope you have a lawyer. And she's like, at the time, no, I don't. And I'm like, you don't have a lawyer right now? And at that point, you know, I was starting to tap into my network and former colleagues on, let's look at some of these law firms. And the Katz Banks Marshall firm was the one that I started to talk to before I decided to go on record. And I wanted to learn a little bit more. And Emily said, yeah, you know, maybe time's up legal defense fund. There's some other things. And we really dig into it. The Me Too movement, which was based on Harvey Weinstein, they created this whole Time's Up Legal Defense Fund. And Lisa Banks and Deborah Katz supported a lot of those clients. So they have this unprecedented, I would say, following and respect when it comes to these types of workplace issues, given the high profile cases that they've been a part of. So naturally, that was the law firm that I wanted to look at. When we found out about the videos, again, Lisa and the team, they were going to review whether or not they take on this as a case. And then finally they agreed. And about 40 of us at this point are represented by them. Gloria Aldred was another one with the cheerleaders. A few cheerleaders were represented by her. And I'm sure there's some other firms we don't even know about if other people had other choices. Lisa immediately got in touch with the NFL, wanted to really get her arms wrapped around the situation on what is this investigation? What's Beth Wilkinson's role? Lisa, from my perspective, I think she really helped push for the league to push Dan Snyder to allow those with NDAs to not have the NDA effective in order to participate in the investigation. And I think that's a big piece in this puzzle, is that a lot of people came forward that likely had NDAs that are not comfortable being publicly on record right now that participated in the investigation. At the same time, there's likely people that participated in the investigation that were needed to corroborate stories, but they had these NDAs in place. So the fear of this report coming out, now we all understand it's an insult to our intelligence that you can't redact our names and put some anonymity behind this. It's ridiculous. But I think there's a few things that obviously Roger Goodell, Dan Snyder, all these folks are worried about, is the sheer volume of people that participated, both current employees, former employees, I don't know about players, coaches, the whole gamut could have participated in this thing. So Lisa Banks has been outstanding. We've worked very closely with her. I think even as the Gruden emails got leaked, we're like, we're going to have a conference call, Lisa. We probably drive her crazy. Like, I mean, we have a group text with her and everything. Like, we're going to talk. We're writing the sponsor letter. We're writing the owner letter. Like, she's been really supportive of everything we're doing. And we even have, you know, we have some really strong PR backing as well to help us with directionally if we need that. So I think the beauty of this firm, and we get a lot of criticism, or at least I did, and I'm sure Emily did when she first went on record, was, why didn't you all speak up sooner and all this? And going back to my point, without an infrastructure like Time's Up Legal Defense Fund doing this pro bono, by the way, there's no way we would have been able to have the fight we would never have been able to show up. And this has only been around for about 3 years. So it's firms like that and participating in that Time's Up Legal Defense Fund that really make it strong to go after these very large, powerful organizations. I mean, wasn't the report recently that Goodell is one of the highest paid executives in the country? Didn't really realize that, but it's a good example of what we're up against now.
There's probably, I mean, we could probably do an hour or two just kind of going through some stories, but I mean, from the legal perspective, or just from, you know, the administrative perspective, in order to, we'll say, apply exponential pressure to an owner to potentially have a league force them to sell the team, it involves pretty serious accusations. And in modern sports, a league, at least as far as I'm aware, has not forced an owner to sell, but public pressure has, at least in some instances, made an owner, made the decision to voluntarily sell. So, you know, Megan, we've spoke about this instance, you know, with Larry Michael, and the comment that Larry Michael made, it's attributed to him, it's an allegation, is that he was making this video that you mentioned, these, you know, I think it's the same video, right? These zoomed in shots that was made for the purpose of Dan Snyder. I haven't seen the allegation that Dan Snyder has said he wanted that or had said it really anything, but I'd like to kind of give you guys the floor. And Anna, we'll start with you. You know, you mentioned that the employees, you know, or employers or maybe supervisors would berate you for certain things, but I want to make sure that, you know, we give you guys the floor to tell us, you know, tell a story. And you guys have been speaking amongst yourself, I'm sure, for years. And Anna, you mentioned telling friends that really didn't believe you with what went on at Washington Football HQ. So I don't know, the floor is yours. During your time there for a number of years, what's some of the things that you saw that, you know, you feel comfortable talking about that maybe people just wouldn't believe?
Yeah, I mean, one starting with like the president of business operations threatening his employees that he was going to punch him in the face, just casually, you know, it would be in a conversation of, why didn't you do this? Why didn't you do that? Why is it like this? And then all of a sudden it'd just be a comment of, you know, if it's not done like this, like, I'm going to punch you in the face. And, you know, our way of surviving that would be to almost joke about it afterwards and be like, well, yeah, I dare him to punch me in the face kind of thing, right? Because it was always a threat. But you never, you know, you should never hear that from your boss telling you that. We would hear higher up executives make comments about women's clothing. And it wasn't just a casual, oh, you look nice today. It would be followed by like, oh, you know, your jeans look great today, or like, what jeans are you wearing? Or, you know, if, you know, what would you do in that outfit? And you just casually hear these, you know, going on in the hallway. And then, you know, just hearing from other, you know, we would have our colleagues kind of come over to our side and say, you know, this person said this to me. And, you know, you just be there like, I'm so sorry, like, because you couldn't do anything about it. And, you know, one of the things with me was that two of my situations, you know, I was able to essentially say something back to these individuals that, you know, for me, luckily stopped the harassment. The one situation was where, you know, I was texted inappropriate comment, and you know, my heart dropped to the pit of everything, you know, like I was like, oh my gosh, like, did you really just say that to me? And I was shaking and I texted back, please don't say that to me ever again. And, you know, part of me thought, okay, if there's going to be retaliation, then there's going to be retaliation, but like, this is it, that I'm not going to have this. And then after that, there was no comments made to me. However, I'm not gonna lie, I felt guilty because I still heard of other women being harassed by this individual. And another comment that was made to me was on a regular basis. It was like, you know, on casual Fridays, oh, what jeans are you wearing today? You know, and I would joke back of, you know, I'm gonna have to wear an Amish skirt to stop you to make those comments. And then finally I was able to say something and then the comment stopped. However, you know, me saying no to stop those comments for me somehow did not translate. Maybe I should stop making comments in general to everyone else. And, you know, one of the things that through the article that came out last year and people, you know, having the responses via Twitter and just the media of why we didn't come forward, I came forward 7 months prior to my departure. I told the assistant general counsel what had happened to me. I sat in his office. I cried. I relived everything. He wrote in his journal of everything that had happened. And that was it. I didn't hear anything back. The two individuals continued to work there. I know a couple people that had also said something and collaborated, but nothing was done. And at that point, I was like, that's fine. You know, it is what it is. And that's kind of how I had to train my mind into a survival mode of it is what it is. At that point, things were looking up in general with the new hires that we had in 2018. But at the end of that year, and that's why I didn't really survive into 2019, was because I was over it. And I showed that. And, you know, I remember one instance where I had called out one of our VPs for essentially, you know, being very verbally abusive towards my colleague. And I had called him out on it. And he brought me into his office and he had made a comment of, I needed to stop policing people because I would get a reputation for calling out this behavior. And that would not be a good thing for me. And he probably thought he was doing it in the best interest of myself. However, in my head, I'm thinking like, okay, you just don't want to be called out for the bad things that you're doing. Like, that's fine. Okay. And part of me felt almost a little proud that I had intimidated him into saying that to me, that what I was saying was considered policing because he knew it wasn't right, but he continued to do it later on, of course. But that me saying something was considered detrimental to myself and not to him.
Megan, I'm going to give it over to you in a second. I mean, if you're not comfortable, then that's not the purpose. The purpose is to share whatever stories you feel comfortable saying. But I will ask, you know, you mentioned two or three individuals without saying who or what or what position. Are any of those individuals still with the organization as far as you're aware?
They're not. And honestly, they had all left, with the exception of one, I believe, they had left after or like during the time of the article. Okay. So like it brings back to, you know, if this article hadn't come out, if Emily hadn't spearheaded this, a lot of these people would still be working there, unfortunately.
Megan, and I know, you know, we spoke a little bit about Larry Michael, who, you know, I think as you said, he left the organization on his own volition, but around the same time of the article. He's one that's been kind of publicly named in this. Same question, you know, we asked to Anna. Is there any stories that you feel are important to share that you feel comfortable sharing that the public might not know and might kind of cast a brighter spotlight on what went on at headquarters?
Yeah, I think there's like which story to share. To echo, obviously, there always were comments made about our bodies. I would hear comments about other people. There was also a lot of derogatory comments, even to men, around intelligence or a lot of, you know, it was a very hot tempered, couldn't get things done fast enough, very leading with fear kind of mentality. And to what Anna mentioned earlier, like, okay, I'm doing a good job, but it's never going to feel right. And I think it's that level of adequacy later in your life. I mean, and it's not just like, oh, you look nice today, Megan. It's like, I mean, it's one of those things where it's like, my face is going to turn beet red if I tell you exactly the words that came out of people's mouths or following me in the parking lot, or, you know, it was just something that sadly, like, we were completely outnumbered. I mean, you're talking about, you know, 60 some players, including practice squad coaches. I think about, and I share this also, it's outside of just the sexual harassment and the bullying, there were some safety issues as well from my perspective. And these are things that I had tried to address that I think could have been really easy fixes working in Larry's department. I wasn't allowed to travel. And I get it. There's probably a lot of things on the road. Maybe that is a way they were trying to protect me in hindsight, even though it made my life really hard. But say they had an away game and then they would fly back, I'd get a text message from my teammate that would be like, okay, we're at the park. So I would then at whatever time, this could be anywhere from 11 o'clock at night till 2 in the morning. I'm, you know, a 20, 22 year old female walking into Redskin Park to upload the press conferences because the owner requires them to be uploaded within a certain period of time after the games. And I'm walking into that building at all hours of the night where there could be coaches or players that some of them, you never know if they're drinking on the plane back or what the state might be or staying in their offices or whatnot. I'm very fortunate that nothing had happened to me during those times, but being in the middle of Ashburn in the middle of the night by yourself, when all these people are coming back and then they leave, right? And there's, I don't even know if there was security at the time. So that's one example. Another would be at FedEx Field, we would get there so early. And then everyone knows this, fans know this, a home game feels like an away game, the traffic and everything else. But after the game, when we would do the press conferences and things, first of all, I would never get a parking pass. I had to get a park. Well, we get a parking pass, but it would be very far away from the stadium. And I had multiple laptops and G drives and everything else dressed up as we were supposed to be, you know. Now, granted, my department, they didn't really, no one ever talked to me about wearing heels and things like that. That was definitely more marketing and suites. I tried to wear my sneakers where I could, especially if I had to run down the field and get game day footage and bring it back up to the presser. I was trying to keep my feet intact, but I'll say this, you know, after those games, well, first of all, if I needed a parking pass that was actually close to the stadium, I would get that from a coach or a player. There were people that cared about me enough to be like, you're not walking in Landover, you know, a quarter mile, half mile, whatever the distance was by myself, hours after the game. And you're talking about, imagine a Sunday night game or a Monday night game. And same thing, we kind of had like, Anna mentioned like it sounds like you guys would share experiences, but my time there, it wasn't really like that. I think we all kind of like, it was this like silence. Some of us, like it was more or less that head nod, like we acknowledge what's going on, but we're not talking about it. We're not going to talk about other people. So we didn't really have that support system, it sounds like. And then secondly, you know, when we would leave the stadium, some of us would wait for each other to make sure we're walking out as well. But I mean, the commentary made, I mean, it even goes back to like, I made the documentary of the cheerleaders. That was my last production. And, you know, I remember Larry being like, oh, spray the girls down with water. And I actually said to him, like, I'm not making a porn. And I walked out of his office. Little did I know, 10 years later, I would find out my department produced basically 2 softcore porn videos. So it's absolutely appalling. And there'd always be comments made about women's, you know, literally about their bodies, what they would do to them, myself included. Yeah, it was just a very, just a completely unprofessional place. Like, I'm trying to think, there's so many stories, but you're going to hear the repeated ones, especially for women, where we're really, I know it's objectified, it's one word, but if it's constant and people are just popping by your office, following you to your car, constant.
I know you mentioned that, you know, one or two of those videos or both of them were set to Snyder's favorite band. So how much do you guys think he knew? I mean, it's hard to believe that the owner of the
Absolutely believe that he ordered the creation of those videos. And I believe there's probably more of them. We just happen to have copies of 2008 and 2010.
Yep.
There's no reason Brad Baker would go on record explaining this situation. I did not know about it, but that doesn't mean other people I worked with didn't know about it. There were often times we would have meetings in Larry's office, then people were dismissed. Other people would stick around. There were also times where a producer would be in the main editing bay and the hot tempers don't walk in here. I'm working on a project. And then we knew, especially me as a production assistant or intern, oh, I'm not going to walk in that office. They're working on something important. So there's obviously times that this could have taken place. So I absolutely believe that this was an order by the owner. There's no reason Brad Baker would ever go on record saying otherwise. I had to do a lot of encouraging to get him to talk. I know what the month of August 2020 looked like.
Yeah, and he knew who to, if he didn't know, he knew that he was able to surround himself with the people that did. And I say that because a lot of the people that worked at the organization for such a long time had previously worked with him at his previous company, Snyder Communications, I believe. So when he bought the team, he brought a lot of those people over, people who had no experience in sports and actually had no business working in sports. So he knew his small circle. Mm-hmm. And that's something that we would always talk about is like he had a very small circle of people around him, which then, you know, started to become scapegoats in situations throughout the years. But I don't believe for a second that he did not know of anything that was going on. I think he took the approach of, you know what, it's your business. Y'all handle it yourselves. You know, he almost wanted to not be involved in that because in this situation, he can easily say, I didn't know anything.
I had a different experience though. I definitely saw Dan Snyder in the office. I saw him in Larry Michaels' office all the time with Mitch Gershman, Bruce Allen, all of them. Even when moments like, you know, Donovan McNabb leaving the organization, Dan Snyder had opinions about how the handling of like all of these situations were taken. My experience was this whole commentary of him being hands-off is complete opposite of what I know.
I mean, does that mean to say that you think he was directly involved in some of this?
Absolutely. 100%. And I don't think, and I don't buy the fact that, you know, the investigation might not be looking at text messages or other communications. This is the whole point why we need to see the findings of the report so that we have clarity over what actually was held onto. Because if I recall correctly, and I wish we had Lisa Banks on, is when this whole cheerleader situation happened, I believe they issued a legal hold of all communications, including text messages. So I don't know this 650,000 emails comparatively to other communications that they would have held on to. My experience with Dan Snyder would be he'd have other people kind of do his dirty work as far as emails and stuff, but who knows what is in his text messages. And he would often directly, there'd be a phone call or he'd show up at your office.
We're kind of running short of time. I want to kind of phrase it like this. Obviously, we have a lot to look forward to the next couple of weeks and potentially months with Congress's investigation, whatever else comes forward. You know, and I kind of asked you, the people that you were mentioning in your stories, you had mentioned that all of them at least have left the organization as of today. I'll ask it to both of you, Megan and Anna. You know, maybe it's not directly a story that involves you, but certainly, at least my understanding is you guys are now talking. There seems to be a growing community of former female employees that are sharing stories and trying to empower one another. As we stand here today, we're in November of 2021. Are you familiar with any individuals associated with the organization that still remain employed by Washington in any way, shape, or form that are tied to some really kind of messy or ugly allegations?
I would say we need the report to show that. I don't want to be the one out here saying that there's people, because there's one thing if someone might not have directly participated, but if they witnessed and enabled, then that's something that needs to be discussed as well. But fundamentally, we need to have the report and the findings shared.
Yeah, I think just because you weren't part necessarily directly, you know, there are people who witnessed it and still perpetuated that cycle of abuse. And that needs to be told out there. Now, currently, I really don't know who works there anymore. Most of the people that I speak with, you know, they are no longer at the organization. That's not to say that there is some sort of level of complacency still, because, you know, the owner is still the owner.
I would also say it's worth looking at, obviously, we know based on the press who has left the organization, whether being fired or like Larry was allowed to retire. I think we need, if you're doing some investigation, I would look at anybody that has since left the organization between July 2020 and present day, as well as across the league, if they were former Washington football team employees, potentially having participated in the investigation. Don't know for a fact, but I would implore folks to look at that.
Thank you, guys. And I just want to say one thing also, just Anna, because, you know, this whole thing made you go away from sports entirely. And coming from someone who, that's been my lifelong dream, is, and I'm sure so many different people, young, want to work in sports. And so it's really unfortunate that this type of thing is still going on. And I'm sure it's happening in other industries as well, but there obviously needs to be some sort of punishment. And I don't think a $10 million fine is enough for Dan Snyder in this case.
That's also a $10 million charitable donation to the organization. And we don't know where that money went yet.
Yep.
Right. And leaving the organization, but voluntarily and absent some type of written report for all these other bad players. But
one other thing I'll touch on too, and to your point, the situation with the Blackhawks player that just came out, Kyle, I think what's amazing about that is his speaking out now is going to allow for the social stigmas to start to pass when it comes to men coming forward. And that's something that I'm imploring as well of my former colleagues. I don't want them to be, you know, made fun of or picked on if they come forward for being bullied and degraded, because this was a terrible environment for them as well. So I'm hoping that by folks like Kyle coming forward is going to give other men courage to do the same, because we need them as we continue to move forward as well.
So certainly I still think this is the tip of the iceberg, but yeah, thank you both, Megan and Anna, for sharing your stories, and hopefully we turned more people onto your story and the fight of the former employees to get the truth out. Any parting words before we end the discussion?
Thank you. Thank you for having us. And, you know, hopefully this helps move what our goal here is.
Thank you.
Well, thank you both for this very enlightening conversation. And yeah, we'll continue to keep a very close eye on this story. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks.
So that was a lot. We got through it. Certainly some heavy allegations. You know, and all we're doing here is trying to provide a platform for people to tell their stories. I think it's, you know, a little bit unfair that the NFL has told us that 650,000 emails exist and they're not telling us what's in the rest of them. And I think it's just the most obvious game of kind of hide the ball that the owners are trying to play with us. We all know that Roger Goodell exists as a punching bag to try to hide owners, you know, and hide their wrongdoings. But at a certain point, I think this has crossed the line with Dan Snyder. I don't know at what point an owner should be forced to sell his team, but I find it very odd and very suspicious that we don't know what happened in this investigation. We have some really dark findings here. So I don't know, Steph. Listen, I love the interview. I love the conversation. I'm leaving more frustrated than when I started.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that stuck out to me the most was the fact that Anna left sports, working in sports as a whole, after her experience with the Washington football team. She was with the Spurs before, had a great experience there, and went over to the Washington football team for 4 seasons and had to get out. And so coming from someone that's always been my dream, it's really unfortunate to hear. And it just doesn't sit right with me.
So Megan worked with the team beginning in 2008, and then Anna worked with the team, you know, almost within the past couple of years, she worked with the team. And they said, even though they weren't at the organization at the same time, their stories kind of ran, you know, similar. So it's Steph, you know, I know we spoke about it offline. Roger Goodell has paid a ton of money. I posted this the other day. Roger Goodell, in the past 2 years, I think has made about $125 million. So you're not hearing me say it wrong. $125 million in 2 years. That's an average of $60 million for the last 2 years. So why is he paid so much money? Because he knows where all the bodies are buried. He hides them, and he's not inclined to throw anyone under the bus. So, you know, I think the NFL strategy at this point is almost like, hey, let's punt this conversation. No pun intended. Let's punt this and let's try to get to Sunday. And then people will start talking about football. All of a sudden they'll stop worrying about this, which kind of works, right? We're not talking about concussions anymore. You know, it's an effective game plan. I not to say I agree with it, but I just, you keep seeing it time and time again. Yeah. Here's what I came away with, my big takeaway. And I've been paying attention to the story for about, you know, a year plus since the investigation started. I have to imagine this is new news. I haven't heard it reported elsewhere. And Megan confirmed this to me offline if people were curious exactly what she said. She said, we have two videos. We have two videos of this Larry Michael kind of close-up, zoom-in on cheerleader or, I don't know, female employee private parts. I don't exactly know what she was referencing. But she said that they have the videos. And I asked her offline to clarify. And she said, two videos have been provided to Lisa Banks, their attorney, who represents 40-plus former female employees with the organization. So they have this as evidence, you know, however they want to use it. I'm not sure if Lisa Banks has provided that to the NFL. But to the extent that these exist, that these truly do exist, I mean, that's a bombshell. I don't know how those exist, right? Let's say, you know, and the allegation here, again, is that these videos were made for Dan Snyder. So maybe if you make one, right, I'm just putting it out there, you fire whoever made it for you, right? And you report them to whoever, and another video is not made again. But if two videos are made, I don't know who's making the videos, but B, if the allegation is the videos are made for Dan Snyder and two videos exist, I'm not sure why Roger Goodell feels the need to protect this guy. I don't know why other owners feel the need to protect this guy. It's not something that someone's saying in their private home, which I remember we talked about in the last podcast that Mark Cuban was kind of pseudo defending. And I remember it at the time. It was odd at the time. It would never happen now. Mark Cuban was like pseudo defending Donald Sterling, saying, well, you know, we don't want to lose. Someone doesn't want to lose their team. It's a bad press. Instead of someone lose their team for something they say in the privacy of their own home. This isn't the privacy of their own home. This is at work. This is involving his team. So again, assuming this is true, and I have no reason to doubt Megan, it's certainly an allegation in our country. You know, the plaintiff bears the burden of proof. But sometimes, you know, photo says, picture says 1,000 words. I don't know. What does a video say? 1,000,000 words? Let's see what comes out. Let's see if these come out. But I don't know, Steph, I hadn't heard of that. Did you hear that?
No, I didn't hear that before, honestly.
Yeah, it was a little taken aback. I told you I was going to follow up with her to confirm it. And she goes, no, the videos have been turned over to Lisa Banks. And you listen to the statement, she's saying that the individual who attributed these comments to Larry Michael has no reason to lie and is a credible source of information. So, I mean, that's the allegation that caught my attention more than anything else. And I'm not sure why we haven't heard a resolution on that. If Dan Snyder didn't do anything wrong, there's no way to substantiate those allegations. Why don't you say that? Why is everything shielded in secrecy? And there's no written report on anything. At least pull in Evander Kane, right? Like you saw over in the NHL. And they said there's nothing to substantiate these allegations that he bet on his own team to lose games. We don't even have that, which I think is just really, really odd. Just again, like I'm leaving the conversation more angry than I was before. But over in hockey, right, this is not immune just to football. The Chicago Blackhawks were fined $2 million for their kind of, you know, improper investigation into sexual assault allegations that occurred under their roof. $2 million, right? And we read the Chicago Blackhawks report. This involves non-reporting sexual assault. You know, sexual assault is a little bit different than sexual harassment, but a really kind of graphic sexual assault that was kind of thrown under the rug for years, for a decade, fined $2 million. Steph, pop quiz.
Uh-oh.
Was Dan Snyder fined more or less than $2 million?
He wasn't necessarily fined, because didn't the money go to his organization?
You are not wrong, but I was looking for a number. The number is $10 million.
Well, so yeah, $10 million. He was fined $10 million technically.
But I mean, just again, I'm not trying to say anything so crazy, but if Blackhawks are fined $2 million for what they did, and what they did is pretty heinous. Dan Snyder's fined $10 million, sure. In the grand scheme of things, we can say it's a slap on the wrist for a billionaire, but I don't know, the Blackhawks were fined $2 million, and we know what they were fined for. Dan Snyder was fined $10 million, five times more than what the Blackhawks did. And I have no idea what Dan Snyder did. So it's a little troublesome. And Stephanie, you asked a great question. I'll give you all the credit in the world. You asked, what did Dan Snyder know? Like, what was his involvement? And I mean, you I mean, Megan gave you the answer, right? She at least in her opinion, he had his hands all over everything.
Yeah, I mean, I can't imagine that he had no involvement whatsoever. I think that's pretty hard to believe, and it's pretty ignorant of Roger Goodell to assume that people are just going to believe everything that he says.
So, you know, listen, it's gross, you know, but we have this platform now across the country. We put spotlights on important issues, just like we did on Nebraska, just like we did on St. Louis. This issue is important on a number of levels, but this aspect of the Washington football team investigation can't be lost. Let's talk a lot about Gruden. We can talk about a lot about potentially Gruden suing the NFL for tortious interference with the contract. This story has yet to be written. And the fact that the NFL is hiding the story, I think speaks volumes. Steph, anything else that we missed that we should take away from the interview?
I don't think so. I think everyone should just, you know, listen closely and look out for one another and don't be afraid to speak up.
To the extent there are any other individuals associated with the Washington football team, obviously feel free to reach out. We're happy to spotlight this and bring some more attention to the case. Yeah. And maybe it'll force the NFL to do the right thing. So that said, as a reminder, this podcast is sponsored by Themis Bar Review. I was talking to Themis about our slate of topics for the week, and this topic certainly came up, and I said what we plan to do. And I think Themis, maybe unbeknownst to them, right, they hear sports law podcast with Dan and Dan and assume it's a male demographic. But I said, no, I mean, this podcast is about covering the Deshaun Watson case, the Trevor Bauer case, the Washington football team investigation. These are issues that are important for all sports fans, all shapes and sizes, all genders, all races. You know, sports law doesn't, it's colorblind to some extent. And we cover the stories that need attention. So this is a story just important, again, for our male listeners as it is for our female listeners. And people need to know, right? We've talked about the Blackhawks investigation in the last podcast. Kind of a messy topic, but, it involves male sexual assault. So listen, some topics are messy, but when you cover the intersection of sports and law, you got to cover anytime it comes up. Themis Bar Review, appreciate all the support, as always, behind the scenes. Those guys cover all things at the intersection of bar prep and law students. Steph, I think we're ready to wrap, put this in the books. What'd you think?
I thought it was pretty good, but I do have to say, if anyone is not convinced on Themis, not to toot my own horn, but it worked for me and it could work for you, but you won't know if you don't try. So
congrats, Steph, on passing the bar. Is that your way of telling me that I forgot to congratulate you on the podcast? I did it in person.
I was awfully worried. I was like, what if I don't pass? But I knew I was going to pass because I used Themis. So there you go. Use Themis if you want to pass.
I am not allowed to say this, but I did have one of our listeners reach out and they said, what should I pick, Themis? Or I'm not going to say the other name. There was another name of a company. And I said, well, if you have that question, I have the perfect person for you to speak with. And so I set some people up. So if you have that question, you're like, is there any other competitor to Themis? Like, or is just Themis the greatest in the world? Obviously, Themis is the greatest in the world. But if you do have questions, I'm happy to help you answer those and come over to the good side. Steph is on social media at @sweisenberger_. I am Dan Lust. I am at Sports Law Lust. Dan Wallach is at Wallach Legal. The show at Condetrimental. We just hit a huge milestone in putting this in the books. We hit our 100,000th download. We put out a fancy graphic with champagne and streamers and poppers. Big thank you to all of our listeners that made this happen. Special episodes like this certainly go a long way. Listen, anything and everything sports law, if you have a topic that you want us to cover, if you want to be a contributor to Conduct Detrimental, just reach out to us on social media and we are happy to add you to the team. For myself, Steph, Dan, and the extended Conduct Detrimental family, we will see you next week on another episode of Conduct Detrimental.